The title of the talk this evening is Restless Body, Worried Mind. Restless Body, Worried Mind. So it's interesting, I think, you know, how we practice is so important. It's a tuning fork for the rest of our life. And we have to be very careful the way we actually practice the meditation, because we can throw our whole meditation experience and our spiritual lives askew. This tuning fork orientation is what I call wise view. Extraordinarily important. And I've seen teachings and teachers who are perfectly attuned to that fork, and the effect that has on the congregation, on the Sangha, as people rise up in harmony with that note, so that it becomes very obvious when the fork is a little off in either the teacher or the student, and how we practice, that there is a slight discord. And everyone thinks they're moving in a wise direction, but often it's in accordance with their usual normal tendencies, which are often conditioned away from the pure resonance of how that fork is trying to align us. And one of the ways that this series of talks is trying to tune us is it's trying to take away a direction in our practice. You say, what is he talking about? Our need to give practice a direction actually works against its purpose. We're fine-tuning this. When we think of our practice as having a purpose and a meaning, and as a kind of an adjunct to helping us along in our life, we're actually going off that resonance. Because it's not about, it can't be stated in terms of a purpose or meaning. It's not to help you get better. It's not to help you develop a better character or for you to refine your happiness. It's not about the fine trimmings of a styled life. It's about stopping. It's about arresting that motion entirely. And it's only when the motion of the new usual ways that react and infuse life with our reactivity that this note, this resonant note of the tuning fork, begins to actually meet us. And actually, our heart moves in that direction when we hear that note. Otherwise, it's just another system of self-modification, tampering and tempering with and constructing ourselves. But we're looking for something different. You see, what does meaning and purpose offer us? It offers us a sense of reason for being, doesn't it? When I have purpose, I have something that I have gathered myself around and am leading myself into, and I'm doing it from often a noble and high calling. It gives me a sense of intentionality to my life. It makes progress possible, and it makes hope, infuses my life with hope and possibilities that are not pre-existing, which are all fine. It's not in any way to begrudge or belittle that form of life. Most of us have many meanings and purposes within our life, but this is, we're tuning our fork. When we come into a spiritual form and practice, we're tuning differently to that. We're doing something other than what our worldly, secular lives and the intentionality behind that. We're moving into a different resonance. And this resonance is really taking our meaning and purpose away. Why? Because it's not about self-construction. It's not about self-enhancement. It's not about adding something to us, but seeing who we are. In order to see who we are, we can't be adding something to ourselves as we're looking, because we'll miss what we're seeing. We'll look instead at where we are going, not what we are in that moment. Until we fully observe ourselves for what we are now, without the additional burden of trying to get somewhere else, we will never see the perfection that is here, that the tuning fork is trying to align us with. The perfection that is now, the perfection that we are now, that perfection is inherent not in the disease of our hindrances. And once the absence of our hindrances is alleviated, then we will see our perfection. Once we have done 20 years of hardened meditation practice and we're all monks or nuns, and that we've all accomplished considerable meditation feats, then we will arrive at some conclusion of perfection. That perfection is an orientation to this moment. It is a different way of looking at ourselves. And unless we're willing to look and pierce the pain of what we think we will never see that perfection at all. So these hindrances are not presented as burdens of proof. If you have hindrances, it shows that you're a weakened meditator and that you haven't practiced sufficiently. That if you have hindrances, they somehow mean that you have much more work to do. Because if we reach that conclusion about the displays of our mind, the states of our mind, we are not moving in accordance with the non-directedness of practice. We are moving our practice into a direction in which we have to cure our hindrance before we can abide within our practice. It simply isn't the case, and we will go forever. Forever. There's no end to that. We've all been improving ourselves ever since we knew there was something wrong, haven't we? Endlessly. Workshops. Is there another way to look at ourselves so that these hindrances are no longer an obscuration of mind? They're only an obscuration of mind when we're moving away from them, when we see them as literally a hindrance to what we're trying to be or get or achieve. But what are they in themselves when we stop acting them out? What are we when we look at ourselves free of our need to self-improve, to become something different than what we are? When we look at ourselves exactly in our present configuration, exactly. And to do that, we have to be without direction for ourselves, without scolding, without inadequacy. And you see, even to ask that, all of a sudden we have stopped. All of a sudden the axis crosses. Even to be able to ponder that question, what is this in this moment? Who am I in this moment? What is going on now? Just to ask that question, suddenly the whole orientation to ourselves is different. That difference we feel is the tuning fork of our heart. That is what the meditation is about and has always been about. And that's the fault I find in even calling these states of mind hindrances. It's because when you talk about something like that, you're talking about some limitation, something that I have to get over in order for it no longer to be an obscuration. But when anything is looked at in correct orientation, nothing is a hindrance. Everything becomes perfectly itself. And there's only one substance to this universe of things. And when we stop making a problem out of it, it all turns back in the alchemy of life. It all turns back to that one substance of emptiness. And we along with it. And it's when emptiness sees emptiness that our heart delights in freedom. Not when I'm on the bus in movement. So when we talk about restlessness, we really are talking about the movement of ourselves. And irritation and annoyance and worry and frenetic activity, turbulent. We're talking about this need to stay one step ahead of ourselves, like a cartoon character. Usually forced by the assumption that we have of ourselves or some pain in the moment. And the struggle we have with this pain, all things, all struggle results not from looking at something through that single note of purity, but rather from the accomplished eye of having to get over and having to better oneself. And so therefore, when we are looking at what I need to become in relationship to what I see, there's a struggle. There has to be a struggle. Because this is not adequate for itself. And what's the result of that struggle but a rising of tension, energetic freneticism in ourself? I can't be this thing. This shows me the worst side of myself. And so off we go. Off we go, and off we have, may I say gently, always gone. In the forever of time. But the one thing we really appreciate about struggle is it keeps me center stage. It keeps me really located and ennobled within the hard, noble work I do. How's your practice going? Oh, I'm really having a hard time. Keep at it. What is it like when we are in moments without struggle? What's it like when we don't struggle? When we're not on center stage? How about moments of awe? When suddenly the sense of self has been blown out of center stage because what's in front of our eyes is so awesome that we can't keep ourselves together in any form of struggle whatsoever. Maybe in moments of beauty where everything is absolutely still in that beauty. No struggle. And the absence of self within that non-struggle. And those are the moments we most remember, are the moments in which we are not confiscating and upstaging life itself through our self-centeredness. When we are no longer commenting inwardly, in those rare moments when there is stillness of the critiquer and the commentator, and there's just life meeting itself, and we know those points are often noticed, but the problem is that we then reorganize ourselves back in the center of the stage and then claim ownership to those moments in which we were not. I had a great meditation. I hope I can get that back. Means we got back on the bus, doesn't it? We're often running towards ourselves. No restlessness in that moment, no sleepiness, no hindrance. And establishing that goal sets us off into more struggle, because when we look at the present moment, it doesn't hold the same acclaim, expectation. And therefore, we have to run again after the moment that did hold that. So restlessness. The worried, troubled mind. Here's a quote that I like by an anonymous source. Worry is like a wooden rocking horse. It will give you a lot of movement and something to do, but it won't get you anywhere. When the mind is deeply troubled, you know, where it can't stay on topic. And may I say that if we're ever going to stop, we have to stay on topic. A deeply troubled mind needs to stay on topic with its trouble, not look for something to modify its difficulty. It's interesting, when people are dying, often when they're young, there's a phase of their active dying that's called terminal restlessness. And it used to be very difficult for people, for the clinicians, to see this kind of restlessness, because literally the person is clawing at their sheets. It takes a whole congregation for me to say a word. You're all helping here. Clawing at their sheets, it's so difficult to watch. And the nurses would often try to medicate that, because it's difficult for them to see, as well as it's difficult for family members to see. But I would discourage that unless there was some patient need, because often I think during that restlessness, the person is actually working toward their own ending, resolving their own ending. And especially if you're young, as I mentioned, that deeply disturbing, irreversible fact that we are dying comes to bear. And therefore, there's this enormous need to flee one's body, which is the determinant. Where you're going to end is in the body. So you're trying to, you can feel it. Even though they have no energy, they find the energy to try to muscle themselves out of that situation. But within that turmoil, within that, there's something is quite likely, or possibly, the potential is there for resolution. Not if you medicate them. So often, restlessness is not seen, but the physicality of the experience can be so often, so awful, that we can't hold the topic. We can't steady ourselves sufficiently to endure what the restlessness is about, because the body is a complete statement of mind. Mind and body work in concert. Let us be really clear that the body is a perfect instrument for the mental reactions of mind. It will show you, there's nothing like it. It shows you, it's like a clean instrument. It shows you what mind is doing all the time. And if we're tuned sufficiently to this body, you can feel the body contract or move, or it's in the body. We can feel it. And as the mind states become more difficult, it's more easy to feel. But when one starts developing that foundation of mindfulness in the body and begins to sense the body when it's out of alignment with itself, means the mind is moving off and not holding itself to the job at hand. And so that feedback loop of the body is so helpful. But restlessness has a body physicality, has a bodily component, sensations that are so, it's like chewing on aluminum foil. So you get the feeling of, or the blackboard, the chalk on the blackboard, or you know, just staying in the body is so difficult to do because the mind is trying to scream itself from the job at hand. Now there are two aspects of restlessness and worry that, and I talk about these in conjunction with one another, because restlessness is the bodily component and worry is the mental component, expressing themselves in concert with one another. So the first of these aspects is when reality is lacking. It's lacking in some way. And that can be minor restlessness. We can see the sense of restlessness within the other states, the other hindrances, like boredom. We just get restless because boredom means that there's nothing here worth paying attention to. This moment is not worth anything. It's not. And in this culture in particular, we have that sense of wanderlust where we're in constant movement with ourselves. It's almost genetic. We are all immigrants. And I think moving on to something better is a part of our genetics. But that creates an enormous rising of restlessness, the unwillingness to settle, to be at home with ourselves. And if you add that to the busyness, the infusion of busyness and productivity enhancement that we have in the day's world, you can see that when you infuse that natural wanderlust with and movement with the frenetic, where you can't stop anywhere because you need to be somewhere else in time and place because of your job or because of the demands on your life, the overload syndrome. When those two are fused, you get a restless society. You get one that is soundbite driven, that can't have conversations of any depth, can't read newspapers to find the totality of the story, that just look for the caption, you know, for their conclusion of opinion. And then you get people driven by the absence of depth. And the second aspect of restlessness and worry is that I need to think ahead of myself for my security. Now, this is interesting because I want to stop here for a moment. Most of us, all of us, have a root issue, psychological root issue in ourselves. And each of the hindrances has a root issue associated with it. And each of us are fine if we look in ourselves, we're often driven by one of the hindrances. Predominantly, they're all there, but often predominantly we see one. And if you look at the root issue, which every one of us should know, it's the issue in our life that has driven our life and all of its permutations and all of its displays. And we need to get that so that we really know what that root issue is, that consolidation of what has been driving me, right? Now, for restlessness, often the root issue is something like, nobody was there for me in childhood, it's all up to me now. It has to be through my own, you know, my own work ethic. And it's all up to me, my control. And I can't count on anyone. No one's going to do it for me. Syndrome. Or, I mean, but there are lots of other root issues, root formulas that have created our life. And I'm hoping that each one of us in the course, perhaps, of this evening can come to their own. It's very important for us to know that issue, for one, and to start examining and testing the assumptions which drive us. To stay, keep that issue in place rather than to keep acting it out. Because whatever hindrance is associated with that is just going to become stronger and stronger in our place of things, in our family of things. And this one that I have to be in control myself, that no one's going to do it for me, keeps us looking ahead of ourselves for our security. Because no one's going to take care of me, I've got to plot this course and plan my life out so that it's all mapped out in front of me. And so I can't settle now because I'm afraid and dependent upon that if I do settle, I won't think about then and I'll get, you know, I'll get sideswiped here. So there's a general anxiety that can come from this root issue where life has a kind of anxiety and even it starts moving away from just the need to plan into the present moment, because the present moment can't be relaxed with, because the present moment is going to turn into something else in which I haven't planned for. And so I better get on it, or this thing could get a little go haywire on me. So there can be a pervasive sense of anxiety when we get up in the morning. If hindrance of restlessness is one of the main forces in our life. And many people have that kind of sense of pervasive anxiety about life itself and don't really understand where it's come from or why it's there, because we haven't necessarily looked at the root issue of what has been driving our life and seen how that inevitably has to lead to anxiety. That feeling that nobody's there for me. You know, and then around that comes enormous effort and struggle associated with every aspect of one's life, because if you don't do it, no one's going to catch you. So to flush out those root issues and ask very important questions concerning the truth of those assumptions. It doesn't do any good just to stay with restlessness and know that you'll be feeling restless. That just doesn't work. And that is the way the practice was taught for decades in this culture. When there are assumptions that remain in place regardless of how well you can handle and open to restlessness, and those assumptions are never tested, then restlessness, you may be very good at being able to stay through restlessness until it evolves, until it leaves, which it will, as all things. It'll come and go. But the next turn of the clock, the next tick of the clock, the next crisis, and it'll arise again. Because we haven't understood our relationship to the future. And how that critical element of trying to determine our security within it cannot and will not occur. Why can't it occur? Because we're foreseeing a problem in the future that is not here and now. How can we correct a problem that is an abstraction? How can we plan for an abstract problem? If we know anything from practice, is that we have to experience it. Because the very nature of how we experience it determines the problem. And here we aren't even willing to experience it, wait until it actually happens. We're presupposing it. So it's entirely a fictional reference a fictional orientation to life. And the only way we can possibly do that is to think ourselves through it, because there's no other way our body and mind can reference it. It can't feel it because it's not here yet. And so we try to think our way out of it, but to think the contingencies, the possibilities, are endless, because anything can happen. And sure enough, when that situation does arise, it didn't arise the way we had foreseen it. And therefore, there can be a backlash feeling of not having planned enough. And therefore, our struggle continues but becomes increasingly dramatic as we go through life, realizing that further and further difficulties lie ahead. I just want us to stop here for the moment and feel the utter insanity of this. You see, I have to bring us all, we all have to come down to the level of insanity before we know sanity. We have to have insanity shoved in our face before we're willing to open our eyes to a sane direction. Otherwise, we continue to use insane methods to solve insane ends. And that's what most of our lives just get tied further and further into the knot of our own conditioning. Now, what's the assumptions that lie behind worry? What are these root assumptions besides the one that I obviously mentioned, but the implication of having to do it all on my own, is that now is not safe, it holds danger. I'd like to, for each of us to test out our experience here and now, regardless of what we brought into this class. Some of us may be we may be in an illness. We may be in a crisis. And if we can just hold ourselves steady for a moment and see whether now feels safe. You see? Is the crisis something that will befall us? And the anxiety of that future is permeating the present? Does the now really hold danger? Ever? Ever? Because as soon as we decide it does, we have given our life over to restlessness. And can we think our way out . Many of us, because of that pervasive anxiety that we bring into the now, would like nothing more than to leave now, to find a better place to reside, because now feels anxious to us. So why would we ever want to rest here when this is the heart and home of our anxiety? And so we have to come back into the anxiety. We get away with nothing here. Nothing can be excluded or eliminated. We have to come back into ourselves, okay? We have to retest that which we have run from. Retest the theory. Hold the anxiety. Look around from the anxiety, from eyes that are clear and established, and say, is there safety here or not? Where is the unsafety in this moment? Where is it unsafe? And if it's not, then I will make the anxiety safe, because it is not telling me anything new. It's not giving me any information I need to have. It's leading me astray, therefore I will sit with it, because I can't get rid of it. That's just making the moment, the anxiety, true, and it's not true. So once it's not true, once you have seen that the moment is safe, then you have to live with the after effect of the conditioning of thinking that it wasn't. And so I make it safe. I have to make the anxiety safe. How do I make it safe? By leaving it alone, it becomes safe. I'm going to die. Not dead yet. So the moment's safe. And the anxiety cannot maintain itself unless, until you get restless and want to leave. See how it works? That's the tuning fork I was talking about early on. That's the directionality. We no longer do the very states of mind determine our reality. But when we look at the state of mind, the reality changes 180 degrees and stops dead center. By calling us to task. So the second assumption that drives worry is that I need to think about the future because my future is being threatened. I need to know the outcome of things. I can't ever settle because I need to know the outcome because it's all chaotic. And the future is the only thing that holds hope of any resolution here. You see, and I can't live with chaos because from that root issue of it all being my responsibility in life and everything is up to me, you see, we become the savior. I have to save myself and other people as well about an uncertain future of chaos. So I play all-empower me, the all-empowered me. It's up to me to do all the work. Correct the chaotic swing of life and make it, is it, I mean, we laugh, but is it really that out of reach? The savior complex of it all. And we have to get so sick of this that we say, I don't care. Let it go. Hell in a handbasket. I don't know. Next step off a cliff. I don't know. But I can't live this way. I've already jumped off the cliff long before I get to the cliff living in this direction. And that sense, that other assumption that left on its own, the world is chaotic and whimsical. It's just not understandable, is what we really mean. And if we ever think that we can somehow, that enlightenment or freedom or awakening means that it all becomes clear of how the future is going to unfold, we need to throw away that assumption because it's just the opposite of that. We learn to live with the unknowable. That's what awakening is. You awaken into the fact that you'll never know it and you cease worrying about not being able to know it. And there's another assumption of worry that is one that we carry with us endlessly, is that worry proves our caring. That unless I care, because most of us, when we're so self-absorbed, let us be honest, we don't really care. When we're hurting, it's very hard to listen to anyone else in pain, isn't it? Or to show any kind of real empathy or anyone else, because we're so focused on our own difficulties. And most of us have a tendency towards self-absorption. And so the way we try to correct that imbalance, which we inherently feel because of our self-absorbing quality, is that we think we can do that through worry. I will worry about the person. And worry will somehow show that I really do care, because I can feel the tension and contraction from the worry. So something must be going on for me to get ulcers over whether that person is going to live or not or whatever. And if we don't worry, if we don't carry it forth, you see, worry doesn't always necessarily mean that we're in some state of tension. It's just that we have to carry it forth and keep playing it forth after we've left a patient perhaps who's terminally ill, and unless I keep playing it over in my mind over and over again how sad the story is, that somehow that will slip from me and I won't give it or validate it the way it should be. I won't invest it. And so we think that the heart is that kind of comet's tail strung out over time, where we have to think about the person and constantly hold the person in reference to everything we do, or somehow we don't really care about the person. And so, worry is outcome driven, isn't it? Unless it's the outcome of what our desired completion for this person, the resolution, we just continue to worry. So what is the payoff of worry? I always like the payoff. Why do we do it? Why do we do it when it's so obviously self-torture? Because it's how we know ourselves. It's, you know, Hansel and Gretel dropped little breadcrumbs on their way to the... Well, that's how we drop breadcrumbs in life. We can feel the pain of our existence and struggle in our existence, and then we know we exist. We can plot our course through life by our scrapbook of worry. I am needed. And it's self-affirming to be so responsible for life that everything is ultimately my fault for it coming, arising. I am needed in the world to function. It's like the superhero complex, right? And then there's a romance of struggle. Life well lived, you know. Battle scars to show it. And then it also reaffirms our root issue. We're always looking for ways to reaffirm the central perspective that we have of ourself in life. So let me throw another word out here. Trust. When we only know our own empowerment, then we only believe in our own empowerment. And we burden ourselves to keep proving that we're empowered. So when we look at worry or restlessness, the restlessness will take us to worry and planning. When we feel the restlessness in the body, can we orient correctly to what the mind is doing through the body's sensations? And do we see the view it's creating? Do we see the scene it's playing out? The orientation of what life is when it's being worried through? Can we see worry and what it does to us rather than just play out worry endlessly? Be a puppet to it. Until we observe the state of mind and how it works, you're never going to be able to know what the state of mind does to you. As long as we're acting out of the state of mind, you'll never know the state of mind. And unless we know the state of mind, we'll never be free within the state of mind. So we have to, that's what the whole practice is. It turns us and orients us to the state of mind rather than just endless dominoes falling. Once the state of mind knocks over one, we're off and running. What is this restlessness? How does it feel in the body? What's it asking me to do? What basic root assumption, core issue is it bringing up in me about myself that I've run from since birth, that I've just hardened and believed in? Can I turn to these things and ask clear questions about it, to drive the stake right through it. To turn back down and come to directionless. That's what I mean by directionless. The hindrance will always give us a direction. The root issue will always give us a direction to our life. And we've been moving in that direction endlessly. To turn back to the issue and ask questions about the very supposition, the very reason that we our life has been the way it is, to ask questions about that, stops us dead in our tracks. Now it's directionless. And now a new world can open. And only then can a new world open. Not by playing out the scene. And may we all see that new world. Thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two? So as we sit, what's our orientation to what our mind is bringing forth? Is it like a stone skipping on a calm lake? It just touches and then is driven by the energetic activity of the first touch and then skips into the air of thought only to touch again down into the energetic activity that may be restlessness or desire or fear and then skips into the abstract. Now we're halfway across the lake. Our life is half over. And we've only touched three times anything meaningful. We've been in the air of our abstraction. Or can we drop like a stone to the very bottom of this lake? If we look at our life, we will see the result of our hindrances and its play upon it. That's what our life is entombed within. But that is not a cause for hopelessness. I am not saying that for that we can all become despondent together and see how miserable we become. But rather that we rise up with courage. I can do this. I can do this. All it takes is the willingness to look. That's all. Okay. Any questions or comments from anyone? I'd be happy to. Yes, in the back there. Right. Inherited karma. The question is the root issue that I was talking about in the talk. Each of us have a root issue, a basic psychological reason for much of the activity and worry and pretensions of our life, neurotic displays, for lack of better terms. And do we inherit that? I mean, partly it's a culturally induced, part of it is cultural, part of it is familial, family, part of it is historical, what we have made of ourselves and our, from the various inputs that we've had. So it has where it's come from. The Buddha was once asked that question, and he said, "Well, if you were a person shot by a poison arrow, and you wouldn't let anybody pull the arrow out until you knew who shot you and why they shot you and what the poison was, you would die before the arrow was pulled, extracted. So why not extract the arrow first?" So it doesn't ultimately make much difference how it came. Because if we're looking for how it came, we're quite looking for blame on why it's not our fault. It's not our fault. That's already a given. But it is our responsibility. We are the holders of those assumptions, and it's there that we have to go to question them. So I don't see a lot of usefulness in exploring why something is in me, unless we are so burdened by our own sense of guilt that it allows a little alleviation of that shame. But for the most part, we still have the hard work of looking at directly at those assumptions that drive that particular behavior and questioning those assumptions and whether they're true or not. Yes. Right, as a motivator. Okay, what motivates you is seeing the pain you're in from it, not knowing where it came from. Where it came from doesn't matter. If you feel the pain, how it drives you to distorted and painful behavior. Just take one root issue that many of us have in some variation of theme. And that is that I'm a mistake, or nobody likes me, or something like that. You know, and then when that's an untested assumption, how everything, our job, our orientation to life, to people, to friends, everything is a kind of a leaning to correct that imbalance, and how we play that out endlessly in some fashion or other because we don't understand what it is that's driving it. We think that that's the truth of who we are, never looking at the assumptions of that truth. And so it's always a little bit, you know, off-kilt, off-center. Well, when we start feeling the pain of leaning, of what we're doing to ourselves all the time, which is inauthentic, the heart rises up. That's, see, all of this, all of the Dharma is to talk to your heart, so it'll rise up sufficiently in itself. It can't, as long as we are abiding in the truth of the assumption. The heart can't rise. But as soon as you move into the assumption itself, what is this assumption? What's going on here? Let me know it. And when you move into that pain, you may feel it in the body, and the body again is a very good antenna for where that pain and when that pain arises. And as you move into the physicality of the experience of that pain, not for you to immediately go off into the direction of excusing it, but to hold it fast, to hold it, to stay present with it, to be at home with it. And to just like you're on a bucking bronco, and you've got to break this horse. So it brings memories, it brings all the history with you, and you could just easily sail off back into your album, your family album, you know, but you stay right there in the body. Just you move with it, and new information comes, and the depth it seeps lower and lower, and it just keeps bringing. And finally, you come to this place. Sometimes the psychological bubble just bursts on its own, just from that kind of tenacity. But mostly we don't do that. We see it a little bit, it gets uncomfortable, we go out and play it out again. And so we actually, even though the tire has a leak in it, as long as we're present with it, it'll deflate itself. We go out it goes down 2 pounds per square inch, and we pump it back up 10 pounds per square inch. So we won't let it deflate, because to deflate would mean a crisis for ourselves. Most of us are comfortable within that particular pound per square inch ratio. And we don't know life except through the pain of that behavior. So it throws us into a quandary right off the bat, whether we want the pain or we want freedom from it. And that will be something that each of us... But the more we focus in on what the pain does, the more I guarantee you will want freedom. It's a given. That's the way the thing works. You don't have to make a decision that if you're aware of the pain of it sufficiently, it will force you to freedom, to choose freedom. There's not really... It's only a choice when we move back sufficiently from it, can blame it on somebody, or we don't take complete responsibility, when it's not radically accountable to ourselves, when we can, when we play it out a little bit, you know, when we play with it, when we dance with it, then it doesn't have sufficient force to bring us to its ending, or to determine that we will go to its ending. So we stay in this purgatory, really, the purgatory of it. Yes.
I find this subject of worry and sort of assumptions behind it really helpful to me. And when you talk about safety and death, I mean, there's something there, you know, that it just seems kind of incompatible.
Safety and death?
Yeah, that's it.
Right. Right. That's what drives a lot of our anxiety, isn't it? Yeah. 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 Well, yeah.
And so, I guess when you talk about that, it's like, well, of course there are unsafe situations when your life is threatened. So it's almost like you have to be comfortable with death being safe.
Yes. Yes. And your question? No, I don't mean... You have to be comfortable with death being safe. Yes, you have to be comfortable with death being safe.
So how do you... I guess. I mean, how do you know that before you die? That's the question.
Because dying isn't any other than this. You're projecting something into death that I have never seen it, and I've been with a lot of people on the edge of their life. I mean, I don't know what you're projecting into it, but I don't want to go where you're projecting, because it sounds terrible. But what I've seen is something very different than that. I mean, it's kind of a not knowing, isn't it? If we're comfortable in the not knowing of this moment, then what's death but that? So, how comfortable we are in not knowing what our future is now. I don't think it's helpful for most people to go to the big enchilada of death. Because the mind shuts down sometimes. That's why I went into hospice care and stayed for as long as I did, is because I thought, whoa, this drives everything. It does, it drives everything. So after a while, you want to go there. But you don't go there until you're driven in your heart to go there and understand it. But look at how worry affects you now. Worry really is the need to know what's on the other side of death, because that's undetermined. Whatever is undetermined, I will call death. And whatever the future is undetermined. So our relationship to the future is really our relationship to death. So how are we with the future? That is the manageable death that I can work with. And if we develop a manageable way to work with our future, death will take care of itself. because it will be just another moment that unfolds in our future. So let us stay very practical in this thing and perhaps not go to the big thing, but deal with the moments of anxiety and chaos that we believe is just up around the bend. And see that they're manageable. That when we come to that bend, in actuality, it's very manageable. It's the infusion of energy we give in trying to make it safe before it arrives, not in what we have to do when it arrives. That's what makes it unmanageable. And to keep seeing that over and over again, this is ridiculous. To plot out my course as if life was determined in that way, or could possibly be determined in that way. Like studying for your SATs your whole life. Right? Right? Yes. Can.
Yeah, and then there's the other goal of trying to make conscious what's unconscious.
Oh, beautiful.
And to get to that root.
That's right. Good.
And so.
Right. See, it's as good as the.
How do you work with that?
The question is about therapy and its value. I think you're exactly right. It can be used in any direction. It depends on your understanding and the understanding of the therapist and whether you first have to match those understandings and get the right therapist, right? But even if it's the wrong therapist, if you're in the right direction to your own mind, you can still use it in that way, right? But you want, a couple of things are important. One, to get someone who can meet you without judgment and who's willing to go into pain with you, because they're often as unwilling to go into pain as you are and will steer you subtly away from your own pain. If you're willing to dive into it, to really look at this thing, and not to make external responsibility, not depend external responsibility on family and all of that. A little bit of that's fine, but then, okay, this is resolved here and now, let's go. And somebody's willing to go with her and match you step by step with their intimacy and openness, then you've got a good therapist, regardless of whether they understand your spiritual orientation or not. It doesn't matter. All you want is an extra pair of eyes validating your sense of worth and the moment that you think you're worthless. Because that's where the assumptions, the core assumptions will take you. And it's helpful to look up and to see that eye non-flinching, because it validates the unflinching part of you that can steady itself even within that story. Even within the pain of what we believe about ourselves. That's a good therapist. And that's the end of this evening.